Okay, this is chapter 4, and as usual, I'm going to start with the selection in italics at the beginning that sort of gives us a preview of what to expect in the chapter. Eliza's sorrows, preparation to embark, driven through the streets of Washington, hail Columbia, the tomb of Washington, Clem Ray, the breakfast on the steamer, the happy birds, Aqua Creek, Fredericksburg, arrival in Richmond, Gooden and his slave pen, Robert of Cincinnati, David and his wife, Mary and Letha, Clem's return, his subsequent escape to Canada, the brig Orleans, James H. Birch. And according to Greg's suggestion, I'm going to actually begin on page 31. I'm going to skip the first two complete paragraphs of the chapter. In this part of the chapter, actually, it just talks about them being taken at night out of the slave pen and told to march. And that's it. That's where we're going to pick it up, on page 31 in the middle, where it says it was a dark night. It was a dark night. All was quiet. I could see lights, or the reflection of them, over towards Pennsylvania Avenue, but there was no one, not even a straggler, to be seen. I was almost resolved to attempt to break away. Had I not been handcuffed, the attempt would certainly have been made, whatever consequence might have followed. Radburn was in the rear, carrying a large stick, and hurrying up the children as fast as the little ones could walk. So we passed, handcuffed and in silence, through the streets of Washington, through the capital of a nation whose theory of government, we are told, rests on the foundation of man's inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Hail, Columbia, happy land indeed! So it's pretty amazing to imagine being marched through the streets of Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, as slaves, bound to each other and on their way to a ship to be sent to New Orleans. And his last words there, "Hail Columbia, happy land indeed," is absolutely sarcastic. I mean, he is not, he's pointing out the irony of it, that he is walking in the shadow of the Capitol as a slave, the capital of a country that says that man has an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He's sort of scoffing at that. Reaching the steamboat, we were quickly hustled into the hold among barrels and boxes of freight. A colored servant brought a light, the bell rung, and soon the vessel started toward the Potomac, carrying us we knew not where. The bell tolled as we passed the tomb of Washington. Birch, no doubt, with uncovered head, bowed reverently before the sacred ashes of the man who devoted his illustrious life to the liberty of his country. So he's just again pointing out the irony of the fact that they go by George Washington's tomb, where he's buried, and he was dedicated to liberty, and here they are, the complete opposite. None of us slept that night but Randall and little Emmy. For the first time, Clem Ray was wholly overcome. To him, the idea of going south was terrible in the extreme. He was leaving the friends and associations of his youth, everything that was dear and precious to his heart, in all probability, never to return. He and Eliza mingled their tears together, bemoaning their cruel fate. For my own part, difficult as it was, I endeavored to keep up my spirits. I resolved in my mind 100 plans of escape, and fully determined to make the attempt the first desperate chance that offered. I had by this time become satisfied, however, that my true policy was to say nothing further on the subject of my having been born a free man. It would but expose me to maltreatment and diminish the chances of liberation. So here they are, they're on a ship, and they're heading. They don't really know where they're heading. They know eventually they're going to New Orleans, but they don't know how they're getting there. And Clem Ray, who's another captive man, and Eliza, remember the woman who had lived with her master and hoped of becoming free, the two of them are just crying. They're just devastated. After sunrise in the morning, we were called up on deck to breakfast. Birch took off our handcuffs, and we sat down to table. He asked Eliza if she would take a dram. That means, like, have a sip of alcohol, I think. She declined, thanking him politely. During the meal, we were all silent. Not a word passed between us. A mulatto woman who served at table seemed to take an interest in our behalf, told us to cheer up and not to be so cast down. So mulatto means half black and half white. It's an expression that was used in the past that's not really very acceptable today to use. Breakfast over, the handcuffs were restored, and Birch ordered us out to on the stern deck. We sat down together on some boxes, still saying nothing in Birch's presence. Occasionally, a passenger would walk out to where we were, look at us for a while, then silently return. So here's the amazing thing, guys. There are other passengers on this boat. That's the part I couldn't believe when I read this at first. So these slaves are being moved, and there's other passengers on the boat with them also being moved who are free people. Unbelievable. Okay, let me keep going. It was a very pleasant morning. The fields along the river were covered with verdure, far in advance of what I had been accustomed to seeing at that season of the year. The sun shone out warmly. The birds were singing in the trees. The happy birds, I envied them. I wished for wings like them, that I might cleave the air to where my birdlings waited vainly for their father's coming in the cooler region of the north. Talking about his family. In the forenoon, the steamer reached Aqua Creek. There, the passengers took stages. A stage is a stagecoach. You might have seen it in the past. It's like a sort of like a little car that's being pulled. It's on wheels, but it's being pulled by a horse. Sorry. There the passengers took stages, Birch and his five slaves occupying one exclusively. He laughed with the children, and at one stopping place went so far as to purchase them a piece of gingerbread. He told me to hold up my head and look smart, that I might perhaps get a good master if I behaved myself. I made him no reply. His face was hateful to me, and I could not bear to look upon it. I sat in the corner, cherishing in my heart the hope, not yet extinct, of some day meeting the tyrant on the soil of my native state. This is the weirdest part of the story right now. Birch goes in a stagecoach with the slaves, and he is totally friendly to the kids. He's joking with them. He buys them some gingerbread cookies. Seriously? And Solomon Northup is not to be swayed. He says, I couldn't stop thinking about that day when I would meet him in my country, in my home state. And you can imagine what he's hoping to do. At Fredericksburg, we were transferred from the stagecoach to a car, and before dark arrived in Richmond, the chief city of Virginia. At this city, we were taken from the cars and driven through the street to a slave pen between the railroad depot and the river, kept by a Mr. Gooden. This pen is similar to Williams in Washington, except that it is somewhat larger. And besides, there were two small houses standing at opposite corners within the yard. These houses are usually found within slave yards, being used as rooms for the examination of human chattels by purchasers before concluding a bargain. Unsoundness in a slave, as well as in a horse, detracts materially from his value. If no warranty is given, a close examination is a matter of particular importance to the Negro jockey. So he's talking about a new slave pen where he and the others are going to be held, and he compares it. It has these two buildings where basically if someone wanted to buy them as slaves, they would go to that house and be stripped of their clothes and then examined to make sure that they weren't, for example, they didn't have like a crooked back or a lame leg or arm, just like you would examine a horse before you buy it. We were met at the door of Gooden's yard by that gentleman himself. He means Mr. Gooden. A short, fat man with a round, plump face, black hair and whiskers, and a complexion almost as dark as some of his own Negroes. He had a hard, stern look, and was perhaps about 50 years of age. Birch and he met with great cordiality. They were evidently old friends. Shaking each other warmly by the hand, Birch remarked that he had brought some company. inquired at what time the brig would leave, and was answered that it would probably leave the next day at such an hour. Gooden then turned to me, took hold of my arm, turned me partly round, looked at me sharply with the air of one who considered himself a good judge of property, and as if estimating his own mind about how much I was worth. So Birch and Gooden are apparently friends, and Gooden, this guy, he's sort of checking out Solomon like you might check out an animal you were going to buy, or even just some product that you were going to buy. "Well, boy, where do you come from?" Forgetting myself for a moment, I answered, "From New York." "New York? Hell! What have you been doing up there?" was his astonished interrogatory. Observing Birch at this moment looking at me with an angry expression that conveyed a meaning it was not difficult to understand, I immediately said, "Oh, I have only been up that way a piece," in a manner intended to imply that although I might have been as far as New York, yet I wished it distinctly understood that I did not belong to that free state nor to any other. So Solomon forgets that he's supposed to pretend that he's not from New York. And so when the guy asks him where he's from, he says New York. And then he realizes, oh, shoot, I have to pretend to be from somewhere else. And so that's what he does. He says, "Oh, I was just visiting there." Gooden then turned to Clem, then to Eliza and the children, examining them severely and asking various questions. He was pleased with Emily, as was everyone, pardon me, who saw the child's sweet countenance. She was not as tidy as when I first beheld her. Her hair was now somewhat disheveled, but through its unkempt and soft profusion there still beamed a little face of most surpassing loveliness. "Altogether we were a fair lot, a devilish good lot," he said, enforcing that opinion with more than one emphatic adjective not found in the Christian vocabulary. So the guy was, like, swearing, like, "This is an effin' great group," stuff like that. Thereupon we passed into the yard. Quite a number of slaves, as many as 30, I should say, were moving about or sitting on benches under the shed. They were all cleanly dressed, the men with hats, the women with handkerchiefs tied about their heads. Birch and Gooden, after separating from us, walked up the stairs at the back part of the main building and sat down upon the doorsill. They entered into conversation, but the subject of it I could not hear. Presently Birch came down into the yard, unfettered me, and led me into one of the small houses. Okay, so Birch comes, he takes the handcuffs off, and brings him to that little house we talked about before, where you might examine a slave before buying them. "You told that man you came from New York," said he. I replied, "I told him I had been up as far as New York, to be sure, but did not tell him I belonged there, nor that I was a free man. I meant no harm at all, Master Birch. I would not have said it had I thought." Master Birch. A lot has changed, huh? He looked at me a moment as if he was ready to devour me, then turning round went out. In a few moments he returned. "If ever I hear you say a word about New York, or about your freedom, I will be the death of you. I will kill you. You may rely on that," he ejaculated fiercely. I doubt not he understood that better than he understood then better than I did the danger and the penalty of selling a free man into slavery. He felt the necessity of closing my mouth against the crime he knew he was committing. Of course, my life would not have weighed a feather in any emergency requiring such a sacrifice. Undoubtedly, he meant precisely what he said. So basically he's saying, yeah, this guy, Birch, he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew he was breaking the law, and that's why he told me not to say anything. And he understood how serious a crime it was. And a pause there.